Our guest has had a window into a world that few of us can even imagine. Brendan O'Shaughnessy has spent 2 decades as the skipper of some of the world's most lavish super yachts, sailing their billionaire owners, guests and staff around the world. In charge of vessels of over 100 metres, with helicopter pads, submarines, swimming pools and various pleasure craft, at the whim of an owner with a large entourage and often a short fuse. Brendan O'Shaughnessy grew up in Fremantle, Australia and served in the Australian Navy. He started as a deckhand on his first super yacht in 2001 and gained his first captaincy in 2006. His book about his experiences is called Super Yacht Captain. Brendan's with us from La Jolla, California. Great to talk, Brendan. Welcome.
Thank you. Really, thank you for a lovely introduction.
You're most
welcome. Wonderful to join. We'll get to it, the role of New Zealand in my career soon, but also just following the news where there was a fire alarm at the airport from a toaster. And as an Australian, I always take a little bit of pleasure, maybe call it schadenfreude, if a New Zealand team gets a little beaten, because you generally just do so well that it's quite rare to have the moment to take joy from it. Sorry about that.
I used to say we're a small country and not much happens, but I don't risk saying that very much anymore. but also, a little bit closer to home, a toaster may have caused an evacuation of a public broadcaster. In the not too distant past, the old don't walk away from the toaster. Look, we've got to start with Fremantle. Speaking of contests, 87 it was, America's Cup. Probably the first America's Cup. Was it the first one New Zealand entered, or the first one we got all excited about anyway? What's your memory of it?
It changed my life, is my memory of it. 83, Australia wins the longest continuing trophy. It gets defended in 87. My childhood, Fremantle has always been wonderful, but it was tanning sheds, it was dockside workers, it was a bit grim, to be fair, to be charitable, it was a bit grim. Then America's Cup came and there were parks and cafes and everything painted and fresh. I was finishing my school. I rode my bicycle down and there were big yachts, a 40-foot boat in Western Australia in 87. It was a very significant boat. And then now all of a sudden there was these world cruising vessels and large sailboats. Unbelievable. I mean, the viaduct has lived it now several times over and watched Auckland grow behind it. But for 87 in Fremantle, it was just phenomenal. Changed my life.
Serving with the Australian Navy, did that assist also perhaps with some of the disciplines you require and might need to impose at times with some of the personalities we're going to talk about?
I think I needed to let go of some of that. It might have taken a while to wash out. It certainly, I think it gave me less about discipline, my discipline of others as a leader, more about realizing that in the military you are everyone's an important cog in a big machine, but you're very small and you can take a drubbing from a senior, you can look them square in the eye, it rolls straight off you. And I think that sort of, don't want to use too much of a modern term, but mental resilience has served me very well. It doesn't affect if I'm getting a dressing down for something that is entirely not my doing, but I'm going to be responsible for it anyway. I can smile and look someone in the eye and it just doesn't hit me.
Let's talk a little about your progress as a sailor and then as a captain then. What was the New Zealand connection you alluded to?
Well, you mentioned in a really well-researched intro, I did start yachting as a deckhand in 2001. Literally, I had a master's certificate at the time, but I joined in the role that was available, joined as a deckhand, very underprepared, not a great deal of knowledge underwriting my performance. And within 3 days, we sailed for New Zealand from Monaco. So my first real time in yachting was a double ocean crossing to get down to Auckland for the 02-03 Cup. And that involved Atlantic, going across Azores, Bermuda, Fort Lauderdale, down through, obviously, Panama, then across to Galapagos, through the Marquesas, through Tahiti. And this is me who had mainly just been in, up until that time, Southeast Asia and Australia. So this was all brand new. And we arrived into Auckland. I'm going to be a bit fuzzy on the dates, but I'm going to say Q1 2002, getting ready for the 02-03 Cup. And it was amazing.
It's interesting what we think of as a yacht these days with what's happened to the America's Cup. And I must admit, I do enjoy the foils. I like a bit of foiling. It has sped it up for those of us who are not purists. We get a lot more assistance these days on understanding what is happening. But the concept of what a yacht is has somewhat evolved in many of our minds. And when we talk about super yachts, can you define what a super yacht is as a vessel?
I think it's always better to ask the owner because they want to define it to their means. But let me go through it. I'll say it starts at 24 metres and 150 gross tonnes. They're two entry points. And then it moves up from there. It will usually have permanent crew from 1 to 99 is the range at the moment. And by gross tonnage, we're now up to plus 10,000 gross tonnes with some of the larger yachts. The middle of the bell curve sits around the 40 to 60 metres, which is prevalent now in Auckland. Auckland built a lot of them. I'm just saying Auckland, sorry to be Auckland-centric. But New Zealand built a lot of incredible sailboats of that size and some power. That's that big middle of the bell curve that's 40 to 60 to 70 metres that has between 8 and 18 crew. That's the super yachting.
It's one of your defences, and that's my word, not yours, of the industry. At a time, obviously, where people say, do we really need to have so much money pulled in the hands of so few and to be, you know, talking about these luxurious lifestyles? Although there's more than that. Your insights into the psychology I want to get to, I find that fascinating. But it's one of the points you make that, yes, there's a lot of money that goes into this industry, but actually it is an industry, and in your country and certainly in ours, it contributes. Can you explain more?
I do. Thank you for the research there and the reading, because I do, in the book, speak to the fact that all of the large yacht owners I've worked for have very advanced and developed philanthropic foundations, private organizations. They are full-time staffed. Some of them go back to the marine environment. They've got a real place for that, and they utilize their yachts for marine science. I tagged more sharks in the Indian Ocean than had ever been tagged before from a super yacht. We conducted disaster relief in the Atlantic from a super yacht. Even if they are not concentrating their wealth and their charitable towards the oceans, they all have charitable arms. They just don't want attention drawn to it, which part of me feels disappointed for them, because it'd be kind of nice to see that the top 0.001% gives back, because they do. They just do it on their own terms. And I think a lot of us who sit in the middle land, we could learn a little lesson from that, that philanthropy can happen from one person doing one thing. Sure, a billionaire super yacht owner, their wealth and reach is far greater, but we all have access to some resource.
Let's talk about what you have to do as a captain and the responsibilities thereof, and also as a manager of a large, what's the word I'm after, enterprise. Tell me about the job.
Okay. So the job has a couple of fundamental, if you think of it, like the first filters is safety of life, preservation of the marine environment. That's it. Those are the bedrocks that can't be shaken. You must do all of what you can to preserve life, which I think kind of is inherent, and you also must protect the marine environment, i.e. uphold all of the international pollution guidelines. The obvious one is garbage and don't pump oil, but I'm not going to deconstruct them all, but you have to be across all of those. So that's your compliance level. You must run a safe vessel to uphold those two goals. That's fine. That's your maritime obligations. That's the same as every other mariner. The other side, which you spoke of, this is before we've engaged guests, before we've met a guest, you are maintaining the asset. I think for those that are not in the yacht industry, you might think, oh, it's just largesse. It must be fantastic. You can buy whatever you want, whenever you want. It's quite untrue. The budgets are firmly upheld and captains are held very accountable. So you're managing the business unit, as you introduced, and you are held supremely accountable for your choices, be that efficient transit speed, consumption of fuels, down to something which might seem banal, the cost of the crew food. Was that done efficiently? Once you've got all of that going on, you then have to step forward and meet and greet the guests. So the next stage is trying to meet the expectations of someone whose expectations are almost infinite. You're trying, as I've said, we try and bend time, we try and blur physics, we try and do whatever we can to make a trip unbelievable, which starts, a guest would never, all of that administration that we do on our own holidays, a guest would never touch their own luggage, would never pack their own luggage. Does their preferences are pre-advised. It's pretty amazing what you can do. You move through the night each night, so you're bending time for them. So you wake up each day in a new destination. When I was in the North Island cruising, it was wonderful to do that in New Zealand, because you can just steam overnight and completely change the environment for the guests. So it gives you a special chance to really deliver something that's quite unique.
Let's talk about these personalities, because we learn much. And as we say, you don't name names, you can't name names. People might even try and guess at some of them, but they aren't people who appear in rich lists. We can possibly suppose on the source of some of their wealth. But let's talk about their personalities. And you mentioned how tightly they would look at budgets and what the staff feeding costs were, etc. We're talking, is it almost to a man, and I presume a man, is it almost to a person, micromanagers?
Yes. Yes, full stop. So if we defined a cultural group, depending on what list you're looking at, there's 2,800, let's say 3,000 recognised billionaires in the world. That's a very small country. They holiday at the same places. The children go to similar schools. So that there's a homogenous nature to this group. So if I'm making generalisations, and people say, you can't make a generalisation across an oil sheik to a hoodie, Sanshi-wearing West Coast USA billionaire, I say you can to an extent, because to have achieved what they have, there are certain traits. What you've just said about the ubiquitous interview where it's that CEO and they say, I just surround myself with great people and I just let it all happen. I'm going to call them out on that. I have not witnessed that at all. And if you want a recipe for success, write it down. They manage every little thing to make sure it's perfect. We've heard the Steve Jobs story of obsessing over some design feature at Apple. They show the same obsession about a seating plan for a Tuesday evening supper and everything in the middle. I don't know if I could ever behave at that level. Well, I do know. I cannot behave at that level, but I can see that it is an attribute for success.
Yet they also have these huge entourages. I think the average that a billionaire's family would have is around 294 staff members. How many would you have on the yacht?
Well, probably the staff have increased in recent years. You might have an exec assistant, a personal assistant, security, medical, maybe a fitness trainer, and then a lot of others out in the periphery. Real estate on a yacht is pretty expensive, so you can't have that many. But when a decision gets filtered through half a dozen people, a cup of coffee gets very difficult when half a dozen people have relayed the message. And this just goes constantly. So if the answer is, I wish I had staff in my life, it would make my life simpler, I'll give you a resounding, it doesn't.
guests would not accept having to walk more than 50 metres from the dock to the event or the car. The logistics involved in attending to every requirement of all these people, it's mind-boggling.
It is, but if you take everything as an experiment, it's good fun. It's I wonder how I can achieve this. It doesn't seem like I can. There are regulations against it. There is this. But if you take it as an experiment of, I think we'll be able to get this, then, and you do, and you deliver the impossible dream, then it's been a great day. You may not gain any public recognition because no one saw the feet paddling under the water. But the fact that someone floats through and has this seamless movement, maybe it's, as you mentioned, from a vehicle to a boat, maybe it's from fixed wing to a helicopter, maybe it's getting into the Cannes Film Festival in the best way. It might seem small and insignificant, but if you take your own personal rewards from delivering those, it's a lot of fun.
What of when the captain and the billionaire owner come head to head over something? You write of one person who wanted to go out in weather that you were judged to be borderline. You chose to go. The advice was it's not going to be fun out there. Tell me about that side of the relationship.
Well, I only learnt this late in my career. I wish I had have learnt it much earlier. It might have saved a few incidents. It's never in the captain's best interest to say no to the client. It's never in anyone in hospitality's best interest to say no to the client. So I often preface it by saying, please realise, if I could say yes to everything, my day is getting a lot better. So if I am starting with no, there's a really good cause from it. And I preface with that, another trait, which I think I'm going to do the we as the non-billionaire normal people, should bring into our life, is challenging of information. Just because I'm standing in front of someone and someone is calling me captain, the billionaires don't accept what I'm saying. They want to get down to first principles data. And in our own lives, maybe we are being told by a medical professional, a mechanical professional for our vehicles, someone renovating your home, and we just accept it because they're telling us. I actually think that is a learning point that I have gained from my employers, is that I keep chasing for the information now a little bit more. Okay, you're wearing a suit, you're wearing a lab coat, but tell me why you're telling me this. Give me the information. So what I learned is I don't go up there saying, I think the weather's bad. I go in with my facts. What is the swell height? What is the swell period? They're very intelligent people. They will work it out. And then the next layer will be, and they'll keep pushing until they find a hole in your defense. Is that swell dangerous? No. What is dangerous? Then you've got to be ready not to make it up, but to have the answer in advance. And so it goes on every level. And I think that's something we could take into our own lives, is chase for the data points to make our decisions better.
You mentioned what normal is, and there's one interesting exchange, if I can recall it accurately, where I think it is a billionaire's wife, or the owner, I don't know if they co-own or how this works. I'm assuming that most of the oligarchs and the most of the people for whom you captain are male, and tell me if there's an exception to that. But one of the wives in this instance said, you know, my life is normal. In other words, this is my normal. And did that also cause you to look at things a little bit differently? You've referenced them as the 0.001%. But did it also perhaps cause you to look a little bit differently about people we perceive as being and clearly are so different to us as to what defines normal?
Oh, absolutely. You're really grabbing some lovely examples. Thank you for that. I enjoyed that. And when you said it, it's not always the masculine owner. A lot of yachts are the family yacht. And it is, from the New Zealand, if I could use it, it's the batch. It's the batch afloat. So the normal in that was the daughter. And the example was, we're waiting to go to a teenage birthday party And as a couple of helicopters flew in other children for the birthday party, and she waited on the back of her 70-plus metre yacht for the tender to take her in. I said, wow, this is something I never said. This is my normal. Don't judge me and I don't judge you. And I think wealth, because it's easy to count, is a metric that we use. But I'm speaking to you today from Southern California, and there's a lot of people pushing the edge of normal. And if I judge them through my relatively conservative eyes, then I would pass judgment, but I'm not. I'm sort of going, okay, we are all normal through our own eyes. And that was a lovely moment where that was brought home to me.
There was some bad behaviour, though, by any measure, and again, not necessarily related to wealth. There were instances of bullying or where, you know, a career is ended in a moment. And was that exceptional to other places that you've been and seen?
So, between crew or between guest and crew, I've been quite fortunate where mostly, and I'll go up 90 percentiles, I've had very respectful yacht guests that are caring for crew. At times, their expectations of service is so high that if it doesn't meet up, they almost just can't understand that there's no data point that says 95% was okay. So if it isn't okay, they say, well, it's not okay. The promise was perfection. This is not perfection. What do we do about it? If someone did something was late, why were they late? There is no excuse. Then that person's employment might be terminated. The other area that I speak to in the book is my own leadership. And I think when you said that about bullying and crew, I reflect on what it takes to lead a group of people in a high-pressure environment. And largely, because I had ready access to them, I spoke to my shortcomings where my own leadership may not have been as active to really understand the culture of those I led. And that's way transcends yachting. That's any workplace. That's any team. Yachting, I feel, is a lot like sport. You get a very fast feedback loop. Win or lose, you get that told to you very fast.
It's interesting that you're describing a personality type that isn't, in these instances, isn't about being nasty or wanting to grind someone down. It is almost a trait to be focused on facts, as you say, and data, but also perfection. So is it not about, in these instances, trying to outdo, it's not a macho, I'm trying to outdo you thing. It is simply a personality trait, likely correlated with some of them anyway, to where they've got.
Perfect. That's exactly it. I don't have to assert myself over you because I'm so many layers. They're just different. But I can't understand, and I think this is really honest, why this isn't perfect. Where out in the middle land, you can say, well, I can see why it's not perfect. This has happened, that's happened. But when perfection or the struggle for perfection is the source of your billions, you can't let it go. And your summary was absolutely spot on.
Are there any you felt sorry for any reason?
Yeah. Yes, just lonely. It's very hard to have a non-biased friendship. The friendships are often in place for leverage. I had one billionaire owner whose friends were his childhood friends, and I thought, good on you. They make fun of you like they did when you were a 14-year-old boy. Well done for keeping that. A lot of the others, I couldn't witness many just normal intimacies of friendship, just relaxed friendship. Didn't see it. And also their personalities, that striving for perfection, that absolute focus on managing every interaction, you just don't relax and enjoy the afternoon for what it is.
As well as being an operational captain on numerous super yachts, you've also been a build captain on a number. Does this mean you're involved in the design and build process, or you oversee it? It sounds like 10 times worse than saying, sorry, lunch was a minute late. A wonderful challenge too, though. What was that role?
Thank you. The build side is you're not the builder and you're not the designer. You do get a chance to tweak the edges a little bit. But I'm going to use my team metaphor again. It's the chance to get the culture of your team together from the start, from the very start. And that's very enticing. What you are, you're building a culture that transcends the construction. And from the first person through to maybe it's 40, maybe it's 50 on payroll, you are setting a culture that will move from shore to the build. You're also taking what begins as a raw lump of steel, a lot of equipment goes on, and then there comes that moment of truth where you sail for the very first time. Then it becomes real. Everything goes from static to dynamic. And that's, again, very intoxicating, that attraction to take the static to the dynamic.
Been a pleasure talking to you. I don't know whether Graham Hart's granddaughter is listening in, but she's just on the Stuff, one of our local websites here. She has just posted an eye-popping glimpse of her European holiday featuring her billionaire grandfather's luxury yacht in a video posted to TikTok, actually. You're not allowed to say who you've sailed with or why, or who you've captained and why, but wonderful coincidence. Perhaps she's listening in. Brendan, thank you for the insights. I've enjoyed it.
And no, thank you. Absolutely my pleasure.
Brendan O'Shaughnessy, the book is Super Yacht Captain, Life and Leadership in the World's Most Incredible Industry. It is subtitled. It is published by Adlard Coles, I have.